Hello and welcome to today's first of four CME snack programs on linking knowledge to action in the screening and management of viral hepatitis. I'm your avatar host, Faye Jackson. Today you will hear perspectives from expert clinicians and researchers from Asia, Europe, and North America, moderated by Dr. Sue Wong and Dr. Heiner Wedemeyer. I'll pop back occasionally to administer audience response questions, offer SMART goals, and provide a sneak preview of the other programs in this series. Please note this program was recorded prior to the November 2025 liver meeting held in Washington, D.C. Key takeaways relevant to our continuing medical education program today are shown on your screen for reference.
Hi everyone, my name is Dr. Sue Wong, and I'm the Medical Director for Viral Hepatitis Programs and the Center for Asian Health at Cooperman Barnabas Medical Center, which is in New Jersey, USA.
I am Maria Buti. I am a hepatologist based in Barcelona, in Spain, in Hospital Universitario Vallebrón. And I have been working in the field of viral hepatitis for many, many years, particularly in screening, diagnosis, linkage to care, and treatment for hepatitis B, C, and Delta.
I'm George. I'm George Lown. I graduated from the University of Hong Kong in 1987. I have been working as a hepatologist for more than 30 years, and I also work in China. I'm a chair professor in Beijing and also Shanghai, and I operate my private clinical trial center now in Hong Kong, and working on advancements of drug discoveries and so on in liver diseases.
So my name is Heiner Wedemeyer. I have the privilege to chair here at Hannover Medical School in Germany, the Department of Gastroenterology, Hepatology, Infectious Diseases, and Endocrinology. I've been working here for quite some years. In Hannover, many of you may know that we have a long-standing interest in viral hepatitis, being involved both in translational research as well as in clinical trials on hepatitis B, C, and Delta. And these are the topics of today's series.
My name is Devika Bhattacharya. I'm a physician scientist who does infectious diseases, and I'm based here at UCLA in the great state of California, in the United States. And my work is largely around directing a viral hepatitis program in a large integrated healthcare system. And then my research is focused on HIV and viral hepatitis co-infection, primarily HIV and Hep B co-infection, and with a focus on pregnancy and outcomes within pregnancy. However, we do a lot of hepatitis C screening, linkage to care, and treatment in our setting. And I'm really excited to be able to talk to you all about it today.
So my name is Jean-Michel Pavlotsky. I'm a hepatologist by training. I became a virologist by profession and doing both jobs together as well as I could. Currently, I'm the head of the Department of Biology and Pathology in the Henri Mondor University Hospital, which is one of the major university hospitals in the Paris area. And I'm also head of a research unit related to INSERM, our National Institute for Health. And the title of our research unit is Viruses, Hepatology, Cancer. So we're right in the right topic.
Yeah, without further ado, let's get started. We're gonna talk about all the guidelines for B, C, and Delta. So this is more of a question about how the latest international guidelines for Hep B, C, and Delta diagnosis and management are being implemented in your region, and what challenges remain in translating them into everyday clinical practice? Because this is the big thing, right? We've got great guidelines, but how do we actually implement them?
Yeah. This is a big question.
Yeah.
As you know, Spain is located at the south of Europe, and we follow usually EASL guidelines or EASL recommendations. Regarding the different guidelines, the hepatitis C guidelines are very, very well implemented in Spain. We also have national guidelines that are very, very similar to the EASL guidelines. And I think now for hepatitis C is easy. Guidelines are very simple, easy to apply, and everybody can understand. Regarding hepatitis B guidelines, this is a more complex field.
I think the last update of the HCD guidelines you called final version. Maybe it would be, what are your thoughts? How was the journey of developing these guidelines? Do you still think that you published the final version of the HCV guidelines before coming back also to the other hepatitis viruses? But maybe it's interesting to the audience to learn a little about the HCV guidelines and the history.
Yeah, it's a great question. Obviously, this endeavor has been fantastic. You were involved in it. So we've been both involved in writing these guidelines. Just as a reminder, we did not call them guidelines because the field was moving very rapidly. And I think what was original in this challenge, that we call them recommendations and decided to update them as often as necessary, because the field was moving very rapidly. But like any field that moves very rapidly, at some point the field stabilizes. And I think the HCV field has really stabilized. And what we call the final version of the recommendations is in fact a real clinical practice guideline. And honestly, except for minor points that could be changed or precised, and this can be done in a supplement, an addendum or whatever, I think the guidelines are very up-to-date, very applicable, and they have allowed us to make a lot of progress in patient care. So yes, to give a short answer to this question, these guidelines, in my opinion, are final. A couple of few small things could be added, but we'll not have to write them again, which is not the case of the other EASL guidelines, which have been issued recently. And honestly, if I were in charge, I would have called them recommendations, because I need for both hepatitis D and hepatitis B virus, updates will be necessary on a regular basis.
Let's talk a little bit about like where the guidelines are going and what you've seen in terms of the other international guidelines for hepatitis B, C, Delta, and what challenges you might see in translating them to practice, and maybe where you kind of see. I know you can't give away exactly what the Asia guidelines are going to be, but I, you know, was honored to be on the to hear about the meeting and hear a lot about the push towards expanding treatment eligibility. Tell us what your thoughts are about the international guidelines.
I was first involved in the guidelines in the Asia Pacific Association for the Study of Liver Deaths APASOS in 1998. At that time, so we have our first consensus meeting on writing the guidelines on hepatitis B and C and Delta. And that was our first guideline. And at that time, the initiative was really the availability of nukes comes into the situations, namely the lamivudine. And then this was followed by others nukes. And nowadays, we don't talk about lamivudine anymore. We talk about high resistant barriers, nukes such as entecavir, tenofovir, or TAF. But this is a long process. And a lot of data was accumulated. And we write guidelines who should be treated and what we should use to treat those patients and how to monitor those patients and when can we stop therapy. But the ultimate goal, even at that time, and I think this is the major issues, is to see a reductions of hepatocellular carcinomas or end-stage liver diseases related to chronic hepatitis B with the availability or the proper usage of these antivirals. Now, in 2025, we are going to change the practice with our new guidelines, because having those guidelines with all the screening methods, which is now easily available, we are not seeing reductions in hepatocellular carcinomas due to chronic hepatitis B. In fact, there is a new projections recently in the Lancet commissions that we might be seeing more hepatocellular carcinomas by 2040.
The WHO reported that too.
That's not the good news at all.
No, we have to pivot, right? I think that data really compels us to change our approach. Yeah.
Right. And the guidelines are important because people learn about the guidelines. It's based on evidence and based on experts. And so it would affect the policymakers, affect the doctors treating patients, and also the patients' attitudes towards therapies, and also this the response from our society. So it's very important that we need to modify, I would say, the guideline accordingly so that we can see a reduction in the outcomes of chronic hepatitis, undesirable outcomes of hepatitis, chronic hepatitis B, that is hepatocellular carcinomas and end-stage liver cirrhosis. And that's what we're working on.
That's great. No, I think it's important to hear about the history of it. And I think some of the conversation I was hearing about with the Asian guidelines, it's really important to bring in kind of real life data as you're talking about. So what are the remaining challenges? We've got great therapies that work. And so what have been the challenges? Like, why are our liver cancer rates going up? And how do you think the newer guidelines will help to reduce those, right? I think there's been some discussion about decentralizing care, right? Getting care out to the frontline providers. Maybe you can talk about how guidelines, are we simplifying them? How are we making it so that we can get more people treated?
Well, this is a very good question. I think that, first of all, now we are seeing a changing landscapes of chronic hepatitis B since the impact of vaccinations. As I mentioned at the very beginning, we start to have universal vaccinations in 1984 to 1988, and then fully implemented differentially in different countries in Asia-Pacific region. Even in China, different areas have this universal coverage differently at different time point. Now, having said that, with the vaccinations, we are seeing a changing patterns with more, say, for instance, E-negative disease, aging populations. And also, I think that we are now having comorbid factors such as fatty liver. Oh, in Asia-Pacific regions, we term it MAFA. In the US and Europe, they call it MASA. But the essence is the livers get further damage from the accumulations of steatosis and also from alcohol. So this might be one of the issues. And second issues, which our guidelines is now dealing with, and with our experience, as I said, in the past 20, 30 years, is those guidelines are based on evidence at the time when we do not have so many biomarkers. Say, for instance, the sensitivity and linearity of HPV DNA quantifications is completely different when we start to have all those landmark studies 20, 30 years ago, and which the evidence was based on. And also, we do not have other biomarkers, which is now easily available, such as the quantitation to hepatitis B antigens. It's not there. And thirdly, and very importantly, we all know that in chronic liver disease, the degree of liver fibrosis is the most important prognostic factor. And it is not until recently that non-invasive testing was made available, either by blood tests or by imaging techniques such as the fibroscan, by the EchoSense or the FibroTouch in China's or MRI technology, which allows us to have a proper assessment of the degree of liver fibrosis. So these are a lot of factors was not taken into considerations when we advocate who should be treated and what to use as treatment and how to guide our therapy. And fourthly, because of the drug registration process, at that time I was also involved in all the antivirals in terms of pegylated interferons or NUCs developments. They have a fixed time period, 48 weeks for the drug approval process. But in reality, this is a completely different story. we need to know how to tailor-made therapy for our patients in a more individualized manner. So there's a lot of issues that we need to advance. And I think one of the key issues is the reliance on HPV DNA, and our guidelines, which is in development, is going to get rid of the HPV DNA quantifications.
Wow.
That's huge. Yeah, yes, because you have to be practical.
Right. That test is expensive and difficult to get in many settings, right? And then especially in settings where it's, you know, we have high burden of hepatitis B, and you don't want to hold people hostage, right? Just because they can't get a DNA test frequently. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. And it also fluctuates. It does not stay
exactly,
there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the monitoring might be more expensive than the treatment itself.
Exactly. Which is, yeah, I think it's such an important thing to bring up, right? That's a real life limitation. And so, I mean, we're having these conversations in Africa too, right? It is way easier to just start treating somebody than wait for the viral load. And so why would we not use a tool that works rather than wait for that? So I feel like there needs to be some tailoring of the evaluation, you know, to the settings.
So my first questions would be around your general strategies, your guidelines, the importance of guidelines in the end in clinical practice. Do you have your local rules? Do you apply, I don't know, ASLD guidelines? Do you look for WHO guidelines? How are you, let's say, managing your viral hepatitis patients, and which guidelines do you follow in clinical practice?
Before we continue, here is a question for you, our audience. Which of the following AASLD guideline recommendations for viral hepatitis screening differs most clearly from European and Asian guidelines? Is it A, one-time universal HCV screening for all adults aged greater than or equal to 18 years, regardless of risk factors? B, risk-based HBV screening limited to high-activity regions and known risk groups? C, annual HBV and HCV screening for all adults over 40 years of age? D, screening only in symptomatic patients or those with abnormal liver tests? Or you aren't sure? Go ahead and register your answer now. And the correct answer is A, one-time universal HCV screening for all adults age 18 or older. This recommendation is regardless of risk factors and reflects United States epidemiology and the high proportion of undiagnosed cases. Now let's return to our program.
That's a great question, Heiner. And I think, you know, for hepatitis C, I think that's pretty straightforward. We follow the co-endorsed AASLD and IDSA treatment guidance document, which has been there for several years now, and really has a very diverse panel of thought leaders that contribute to its implementation and its design. And it really, I think, is the norm. There are other integrated health systems that have their own guidelines, but I think by and large, the AASLD, IDSA, hepatitis C treatment guidance is what we use. Now, in hepatitis B, I think, you know, it feels like the ground is shifting a little bit. We do still use the 2018 AASLD hepatitis B treatment guidelines document that is undergoing a revision, as you know, will hopefully be out later this year in its finalized form. That also, coincidentally, has now also been co-endorsed by IDSA for the first time in its history, kind of taking its cue, if you will, from the hepatitis C guidance. But I think what's been interesting about the hepatitis B guidelines is that the WHO guidelines came out in 2024, and really, I would say, threw down the gauntlet for what expanded treatment access could look like. And I think many of us are, I think I would use the word grateful to have, you know, these two different sets of guidelines to be able to reference. Because I think what that really allows us to do is to have a really patient-centered discussion about hepatitis B treatment options. Now, keep in mind, I come from the infectious diseases and HIV perspective, where we basically say virus equals bad equals, we need to treat. And I understand, my colleagues' thoughts on why, obviously that doesn't hold for every person with hepatitis B. But what I think the new WHO hepatitis B guidelines really gave us the permission to do is to really present a different set of guidelines to patients and to say, look, there really are options. So, before we used to say, well, you have to, you, and we still do, but we say, your e antigen is this, your HBV viral load is this, what was your ALT? How often did we check it? When is it elevated? And now I think we can more comfortably say, there are these guidelines, the WASLD guidelines, but there are also these other set of guidelines, the WHO guidelines, that allow for expanded access. What do you want to do? What would you be comfortable doing? And then, it allows us to kind of take that conversation a little further.
I think this patient-centered view is very important, and you may know in Europe we have the new updated HBV EASL clinical practice recommendations guidelines, and we had quite some discussion because obviously we want to make things simple. You just mentioned we're talking about infectious diseases, but on the other hand, we don't only not want to overtreat individuals, and therefore I think these guidelines are important. I understand you have a lot of experience. You use recommendations, guidelines in a reasonable way, but when you look in your, let's say, the general practitioners in California, are they aware of these guidelines? Do they know which patient they have to send to your center where they could start maybe treatment on their own? What are the importance of these guidelines beyond your academic centers?
I think that's a really great question. And I'm going to take another step back, right? Even before we go into the management guidelines. And I also want to reference some updated guidelines that we have in the US around universal hepatitis B screening.
Before we continue, let's hear from Asia Sullivan, a nurse practitioner in California who has been at the forefront of implementing recent CDC guidelines for universal panviral screening for hepatitis B, hepatitis C, and HIV. Ms. Sullivan.
My name is Asia Sullivan. I'm a certified physician assistant here in the Los Angeles area, and our practice does cater to the LGBTQ plus community, but of course we see patients of all walks of life and all sexual orientations and genders. And so in that line of work, screening for infectious disease, including HIV and hepatitis B and C, is some of the bread and butter of what we do every day. We try to incorporate a strategy of panviral screening whenever we can. And so to us, that means incorporating screening for these conditions as just part of a normal workup. It's not anything that a patient has to ask for. It's something we offer right off the bat. We try to take like an opt-out testing strategy. So anytime a patient comes in, whether that is for just a routine annual physical or a checkup, as they like to call it, or if they're here specifically for STI screening or concerns about sexual health, that is something we just immediately say, great, okay, we're going to do some blood work. We're going to go ahead and screen you for conditions like HIV and hepatitis and just kind of keep the conversation moving. I would say that's been a really successful strategy. We almost never have patients opt out of that, even if they may not necessarily be a high-risk population. So we just offer this to everyone as part of a routine visit and try to keep it moving, and that's been very successful for us.
Thank you, Ms. Sullivan. And now, let's return to our faculty discussion.
So again, another 100,000 foot view. Many of you will remember in 2020, the CDC and USPSTF recommended one-time hepatitis C screening in 2020. And then in 2023, the CDC recommended universal hepatitis B screening. Both of those recommendations are centered around two points. One is that the opioid use and injection drug use epidemic in the United States, unfortunately, is continuing. And two, I think we don't always realize what individuals' risk factors are, right, in terms of hepatitis C or hepatitis B, risk of having hepatitis C or hepatitis B disease. So they expanded the screening recommendations. And so let me start there, because I will say that there is more knowledge, I would say, about hepatitis C universal screening than there is, I would say, about hepatitis B universal screening, certainly in my setting at an academic healthcare center. And I think that's the first piece, right? Is you have to be able to remind our colleagues that screening for hepatitis B is important. And then once that has been accomplished, I think by and large, one of two things happen, right? It can fall in a busy provider's day, and it just be, a chart. Oh, this person has hepatitis B. Okay, let me just, there are 1,000 other things to discuss today. Let me just address it the next visit. Or somebody could refer on to ID or hepatology. But it is rare, I would say, in the US that the primary care provider is taking on the role of hepatitis B treatment, a little bit more with hepatitis C, but not with hepatitis B yet.
No, it's the same, I think, in our country that it's very rare that GPs are in the end treating these infections. But when we will come back to this cascade of care where we lose some individuals, you mentioned that you had these recommendations in 2020, 23 for C and the B virus. Do you have the impression that in the end, these recommendations led to an increased diagnosis of the respective infections? Or was it just a recommendation that was not followed? Because coming back to our experience here in Germany, we had in 2021, there was, as part of the general health checkup, a screening was recommended. And since then, the diagnostic rate really increased in this country, which to me was a big surprise. So, did you feel that these recommendations in the end made a difference?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I really think it's about the implementation, right? And where you are and how those guidelines are being followed. I think if you are in a setting where there is not an automatic way to do this, like with an electronic health record-based system, I think that relying on somebody to remember, to do universal screening for Hep C or Hep B is going to fail. I think in those health systems where screening becomes part of a flag, a reminder within the electronic health record to do, then I do think screening increases. We saw that in our own large integrated health system. Once these reminders were put in place, screening rates, which actually I'll say were pretty high already, went up by anywhere from 5 to 10%. We did a survey actually of primary care providers and their knowledge of hepatitis C screening practices. And again, I work in a large integrated healthcare setting. And there, we had a lot of primary care providers out of a sample of 100, about 60%, 60, knew about universal hepatitis C screening. But if you ask them, what are the barriers, the most important barrier, interestingly, was just their self-reported forgetfulness to screen in 60% of individuals. And of those individuals, what they really preferred to have was to have some type of HCV, digital dashboard or automatic screening, anything that kind of took that burden of remembering off, which I completely, look, I can bear, right? I mean, that's what we use order sets for, to remember to do, oh, I have to do a viral, an HIV viral load. I have to do a CD4. I have to do, X, Y, and Z. I think those can become very useful. And so I think it's in the implementation. So that was a long answer to your short question. So I do think for hepatitis C, there has certainly been an uptake. In hepatitis B, we are also seeing an uptake in screening. I don't think they have it has been in place long enough to have data to answer that question. But I can tell you anecdotally, especially with the recommendation to use the hepatitis B triple screen, the amount of consults that we are getting, the amount of just curbside questions that we are getting now about, oh, I have somebody who's core antibody positive. What does that mean again in the setting of hepatitis B has increased substantially.
Before we continue, let's get our audience involved again. Mr. R is a 47-year-old man living in Madrid. He is diagnosed with chronic hepatitis B after routine blood work. He has had a positive hepatitis B surface antigen for more than 6 months. His hepatitis B E antigen is negative. HBV DNA is 2,000 international units per milliliter. His ALT is within normal range, and there is no evidence of fibrosis on non-invasive assessment. He has no family history of hepatocellular carcinoma. He feels well and asks if he needs treatment now or just regular follow-up. According to current Spanish and European hepatitis B guidelines, what is the most appropriate next step for this patient? Is it A, start antiviral therapy immediately for all patients with positive hepatitis B surface antigen, B, monitor ALT and HBV DNA levels every 6 to 12 months and reassess for treatment if these rise or fibrosis develops, C, stop follow-up since the patient is asymptomatic and liver tests are normal, D, begin nutritional supplements for liver detoxification, or select E if you are not sure. Go ahead and register your answer now. And the correct answer, according to Spanish and EASL guidelines, is to recommend regular monitoring rather than immediate therapy for inactive HBV carriers. And now, let's return to our faculty discussion.
The majority of our patients in Spain are chronic hepatitis B E antigen negative patients. And sometimes the interpretation of the guidelines, particularly in those that are patients with infection but without disease, that it's called chronic carriers or chronic hepatitis B infection, are difficult to diagnose and to classify in in an initial visit, and these patients need a follow-up. I think now the new ESL guidelines simplify diagnosis, establish easy criteria for non-invasive tests for fibrosis that allows to treat more patients. But still, the terminology, it's a bit complex. That means that usually only people working on liver disease specialists are treating these patients, making the access to diagnosis and treatment more difficult at the community level. And finally, for hepatitis delta, Europe has specific guidelines for hepatitis delta that I think are important. I was part of the committee of both of the previous ESL guidelines on hepatitis B and the ESL guidelines on hepatitis delta. And what I think is good for the ESL guidelines on hepatitis delta is the introduction of the reflex testing for screening for patients with hepatitis delta. What does it mean? That there is a recommendation that all people HBs antigen positive should be screened for hepatitis delta by anti-delta antibodies. And if these antibodies are positive, then tested for viremia, for HDV RNA. And also, and I think this is a difference between your country, US, and Europe, is that currently in Europe, we have approved a specific treatment for hepatitis delta, that it's an entry inhibitor of the virus. And we are treated our patients with hepatitis delta with this drug that is called bulevirtide, that we have preliminary data, not only on virological efficacy, we have preliminary data suggesting that it's a clear improvement in outcomes. So less fibrosis progression, less cirrhosis, and less decompensation.
Thank you to our international faculty for a very informative program today. And thank you to our worldwide audience for participating. Before we wrap up, here are three SMART goals related to our discussions. SMART stands for specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time-bound. SMART Goal 1, over the next 6 months, increase HBV, HCV, and HDV screening based on guideline recommendations for your region. SMART Goal 2, use guideline concordant approaches to engage and coordinate with interprofessional team members to increase screening for viral hepatitis per published practice guidelines. And SMART Goal 3, facilitate the care continuum for viral hepatitis by identifying strategies that link diagnosis to appropriate guideline-recommended treatment. Just a reminder, please don't miss the other three programs in this series. Collaborative strategies to enhance linkage to care, shared decision-making and motivational interviewing, and actionable strategies to effectively engage with patients. To receive CME credit for today's session, please complete the post-test and evaluation. Thank you again and have a wonderful day.